All right, so good morning, guys. Good to be with y'all again. So we are in the middle of a three-week series. So ladies that have just come for the first time this week, you're getting dropped right in the middle of a series that we're doing on gender and sexuality issues in our culture. Basically, what we've been talking about is it's kind of impossible to go anywhere, do anything, be anywhere without hearing our culture's opinion on gender, on sexuality, whether that's LGBTQ plus things, pride events, whatever. And so what we're trying to do over these 3 weeks is talk about how we're supposed to think about these things as Christians. And last week we began by talking about what Christianity's answer is to what is really the fundamental question that all these issues are getting at. And that question is, what does it actually mean to be human? What does it mean to be a person, to be a self? And so we'll spend a few minutes just reviewing what we spoke about last week for those of you who weren't here and for those of you that were sleeping, because it happens. I don't blame you. All right, so last week we talked about what does it mean to be human and Christianity's answer, and we had this helpful diagram that's much more helpful after I redrew it this week, and you can actually read it. I can't draw and talk at the same time, I've discovered, so I drew before I talked, and hopefully that'll be helpful. So what we said last week was, when Christianity answers the question, what does it mean to be human, it starts with and is rooted in God as the creator. The first way that we're introduced to God in the Bible is that he's the creator, right? Genesis 1:1, in the beginning, God created. And in God's creation, as the creation narrative is unfolding, it's sort of this same thing over and over where God says something will come into being, it comes into being, God says it's good. And then we get to the creation of man. And when we get to the creation of man, the narrative changes a little bit. There's an obvious disruption in the way that the writer tells us that man is created. And through that, we're able to see that man is created uniquely, intentionally, and purposefully. So man is created by God and created as a special and a high creation. And in seeing that, we also then said, well, if God is the creator, so God is the source of all things, everything flows from God, and God is the lawgiver of all things, as the creator, God is allowed and has the right to say how things ought to and ought not to be, that man has certain laws that he's to follow. And those laws we call the natural law and the divine law, and those two essentially break down like this. Within God, we have what's called the eternal law, which is the parts of himself that the laws flow from. So the things about God that are true or about are beautiful are right. And these laws flow from those things. Natural law, we said, flowed out of creation. I'm going to draw an arrow, so hopefully that's legible. So natural law flows out of creation. We talked about the example of murder. So just about any culture you go to, people generally agree that they shouldn't kill each other for no reason at all. That's pretty universal. And we said, well, that's not a divine law. It's not because God came and told them that. But through his creation, we're able to understand certain things about how the world is meant to be. And that's one of those examples. And Paul talks about that in Romans, where he talks about the Gentiles, essentially that they act in ways that are consistent with God's law, even though they never received it. And the second kind of law that we discussed is divine law, and that comes directly from God. And in the Old Testament, that was done through the prophets mostly, and they wrote down God's law. They preached it to the people in their day, and they wrote it down for future generations to read. And in the New Testament, we see the law most clearly, or God's law most clearly, in the person of Jesus, and he communicates his law through the apostles to his people. And then we said that, in addition, man isn't a solo being, right? I don't sort of exist just in isolation. I actually exist in a community. And God's community that he's created for his people is the church. And the church is the place where we are to be built and sharpened and shaped according to God's law and according to his rules. And of course, it's the gospel, right? The message of Jesus' death, life, death, and resurrection that brings us into his people and into the church where we are taught his laws and taught his ways. And then at the very end, we said, with respect to gender and sexuality, we were able to say the following things, both from creation and from Scripture, that there is a distinction between men and women in both biology and role. There's not sort of a spectrum to exist on where you might be one or you might be the other, or you might be somewhere in the middle. We talked about marriage and that it is a lifelong commitment between one man and one woman. And we emphasized both the lifelong nature of that and the one man, one woman aspect. And that all sexual activity exists only within the confines of that one man, one woman marriage. And our happiness, right? So because one of the things that culture is getting at is how do I be happy? What makes me happy? Well, true happiness is ultimately found in communion with God through Christ. But of course, the reason we're talking about this is that our culture ultimately doesn't see gender and sexuality this way. And we also talked a little bit about, so the way culture sees it is there are very much categories and they're very much central to who people are. you might think that when we're talking about how we should behave sexually, what gender should be, how we understand it, we're arguing about the definitions of those things, or what we're arguing about is how natural law and divine law are interpreted. But one of the things that I want you to see this week is that there's actually a more fundamental disagreement on the nature of what it means to be human. We're not just talking about how we understand God's law and how we live it out. So I have a task that I need two volunteers for. Gideon! Peyton. Peyton?
Yes.
I got it, yes. I looked over at your brother and I was like, don't let me get this wrong. I got it right, good. All right, come on, come here. All right, which one of you is more, you know what, it's you. You take this, Gideon, I want you to go stand over by Dan. Okay, I'm going to give you instructions. I put the instructions on there, you don't need to read them. I'm going to give you that and I want you to go stand by the door. All right, here's what's going to happen. Gideon, you need to get Peyton to walk to you. Peyton, you can only do what Gideon tells you to do, okay? And you can only give him the code words that are on the paper. So you cannot give him direct directions. You have to use the code words, okay? If you can do this in 2 minutes...
Would I be interrupting him with some of these?
You're not calling him them. You're just saying them.
Oh, great.
Oh, my goodness. Okay, so here's the deal. You have 2 minutes. If you can get him to you in 2 minutes, I'll pay you both money.
How much?
You're not Gideon, do you know the expression, don't look a gift horse in the mouth? Don't ask me how much money you're getting. Set a timer for 2 minutes. Go.
Fuzzy mama.
It's not
going to
happen.
Do the direction first. And then
okay, mama fuzzy. Mama fuzzy. Look at it.
I am. It's not
okay,
going to work.
Mama peppy.
What are you doing?
I think you messed up the thing.
I'm sure he's the one that messed it up.
Okay, elephant. Elephant.
Oh, this is good. This is better than I hoped.
I can't move backwards 2 steps.
Okay, I'm done.
Oh, we have a change. Anthony's going to try now. Gideon has forfeited his chance at real world dollars and passed the paper to Anthony.
Okay,
Mama.
These are way less funny the order you're reading them in, by the way. But that's fine.
Why is Chunky on the
Okay.
Stop.
He's got to listen.
Elephant. No, wait. Well, yeah. Elephant. Not that. Okay. Elephant. It's really hard, Caleb. You want to try?
Five. Four. You don't get 2 new minutes.
What?
All right. Time is up. Time is up. Thank you to our 3 participants, which was 1 more. Now just go ahead and give him a hand. That was good. So, all right, so what happens?
Stupid.
Okay, Gideon is many things. Stupid's not one of them. What happens? Who knows what happened?
You break the whole system.
Instructions are different.
Obama.
You
break the
whole system. You just got the reference completely wrong. So, anyway, I did rig the system. Me rigging the system wasn't the point of the illustration. I don't owe you anything. The point of the... Yeah, you were supposed to read the adjective first, but anyway. The point of the illustration was this. So Gideon, on his paper, and Anthony after him, because Gideon gave up in the face of adversity, had one set of instructions, and the paper that Peyton had a completely different set of instructions. And somebody voiced the idea that perhaps they were reversed, which was not correct because I'm smarter than that, and I mixed them up. But that's the general idea, right? So they were working off of 2 completely different sets of instructions, 2 completely different paradigms, and so you saw how hard it was for them to work together.
What's a paradigm? 20 cents.
The way that you look at something, your approach to the activity. Guys, you ignore the dad jokes and just hope they go away, okay? And we've just lost Joel for the rest of Link. He's going to be on. Joel, did you write that down for class next year? You've got it, okay. All right, anyway. Anyway, so they were working off of two completely different sets of instructions, right? They were incompatible. So when Gideon thought he was telling Peyton to do one thing, poor Peyton was actually walking into the wall. And this is similar to our conversation about these issues of gender and sexuality with the world and the culture around us, because we might think that we're arguing over a definition or over how we understand natural and divine law, but we're not. The difference is actually the entire way that we see the world and we see humanity. So this is a book by a gentleman named Carl Truman, which was very helpful to me as I was preparing. I won't recommend it because most of you probably wouldn't get through it. And yeah, I don't blame you. I wouldn't have gotten through it in high school either. So, but I want to read you a quote from here where he kind of describes the situation as we face it today. He says, while sex may be presented today as little more than a recreational activity, sexuality is presented as that which lies at the very heart of what it means to be an authentic person. That is a profound claim that is arguably unprecedented in history. How that situation comes to be is a long and complicated story. And he goes on to basically say that he's going to do his best to work through the story, but he's obviously not going to be able to hit every little detail. So this book is a few hundred pages, so I have the same caveat for you this morning, except even more, because I only have about half an hour. So as we're talking through this, and as I'm trying to hit some of the major points in how our culture has come to understand these things, I'm going to have to leave some stuff out. I'm going to skip over a few things that might tie them together. But the reason I say that is, if I say two things and you're like, wow, I don't understand how those are connected at all, feel free to ask me. I'll be happy to try to connect the dots for you. And you can, you know, text, email, call, come up to me, whatever. So we're going to go ahead and do that this morning. And again, the goal this morning is to give a bit of the story of how our culture has come to think and believe the way it does. Most importantly right now, that who I'm attracted to or what gender I feel like is the primary thing that defines who and what I am as a human being. So the place we're going to begin is actually at the bottom of this chart. The very first thing that sort of happens and is the elevation of the self, the elevation of who I am inside. So we noted that Christianity sees man as a unique and special creation, right? So Christianity agrees that there is something special and unique about man. But in Christianity, we note that in God's, that man's value comes from God, it flows from God, and it's because he is created by God in his image that he has any dignity, value, or worth. And we also said that in God's plan, the church is the community that helps us understand our dignity and value and directs our behavior and purpose to the glory of God. But we know, so not everyone lives within the overlap, this overlap between God's space and man's space. Not everyone lives within the community of the church. And so it's actually not just the church, which is kind of a small community that we're a part of, that does these things, that helps us understand our behavior and how that ought to be and who we are. We have a community in our larger society, right? So we all live, for the most part, in this area of Greenville County, Spartanburg County, this kind of general area within the state of South Carolina, within the United States. We're part of Western culture. So there's this larger community that helps to shape who we are. And in different periods of time, that's worked in different ways, right? So there have been times where the Roman Catholic Church, for example, was the primary establishment that all of this stuff kind of flowed from, right? You lived under the church, and the church told you what to think, how to think, what to do, etc. And so something happens, though, right? So we have this historical paradigm, at least in Western culture, where we live in this community, and it's generally sort of related to what we talked about here. It may not be true Christianity, but what you get is generally this concept, right? That there is a God that he created, and he created man, and he has given us certain laws and certain things that we are to obey and certain ways we are to be. But a thought in human history begins to develop. So question, art students, romanticism, what is it?
Rousseau?
Yeah. Very good. Yes. That's a good. You were just waving.
Hey.
Okay. Give me an idea. What is it? What is romanticism? Okay. Okay. And what else? So from an art perspective, what does that mean? Right. Okay. So basically what you're all kind of circling around and getting at, and you're all right in what you're saying, is that the basic tenet behind it, at least especially when it comes to art, so art, literature, whatever else, is to express the feelings that an artist has. It was considered that the content of art had to come from the imagination of the artist with as little interference as possible from artificial rules dictating what a work should consist of. So what does that mean? It means that when I'm producing a work of art, when I'm painting something, when I'm writing a poem, that should flow out from me and from my emotions and from what I experience. And nothing outside of myself should be able to dictate what my art should contain or look like or have in it. So basically what's happening is we're centering some authority on experience inside of myself. And I'm saying the art world or the culture or the church shouldn't be able to tell me, hey, you can't express that emotion in your work. That's wrong. And so it was primarily important what the artist felt and experienced, and nothing should get in the way of the artist or the writer, whoever else, expressing whatever it was that welled up in their imagination. So the primary takeaway about this kind of line of thought, and Gideon mentioned Rousseau, and Rousseau had a lot of writings that helped sort of articulate a lot of this, was that authenticity is good. So being authentic is good, and what defines authenticity is being most true to oneself and what comes out from the inside of me. That is what is most authentic. There's a philosopher named Charles Taylor who has kind of a helpful quote to understand how this all reaches out, not just from art, but into how people think about themselves. And he says, the understanding of life, which emerges with romantic expressivism in the late 18th century, that each of us has his or own, her own way of realizing our humanity, and that it's important to find and live out one's own, as against to surrendering to conformity from outside by society or previous generation. So what's he saying? He's basically saying the thought process that comes to take shape is what is important, the way I achieve happiness, is that I understand who I am inside, what I feel inside, and I'm able to express that. And the community outside of me isn't able to shut that down, stop me from doing that, repress me from doing that, or anything else. And of course, this presents a problem or a critique of what community traditionally was, right? So if you lived during an era when the church was sort of, the Roman Catholic Church was sort of the dominant political and religious structure, you had all kinds of rules and regulations about what you couldn't do, and part of society's role in that was to shape you into being a certain way, to acting a certain way, and living out a certain way. But if a community is doing that, if it's controlling the behavior of its members, then it's inherently going to suppress the true, authentic selves of some of its members, right? So what the church is telling me I can and can't do, if inside of me I have a strong desire to do that, or I feel that I am that way, or I want to be that way, traditionally, it's the church's job to say, no, right? God has done this. This is truth. This is how we're to order our lives. But in this line of thought, that actually becomes an evil thing to do, because now what's happening is you are suppressing and oppressing who I really am inside, and now that is a bad thing that community does. So consider how historical societies might have functioned. So think about like lords, landowners, peasants, right? What was that dependent on primarily? How did you find out which category you fit into?
Birth.
What's that?
Birth.
It's just who you happen to be born into, right? What family you happen to be born into, who happened to be your parents, dictated which strata of society you got to sit in. And this line of thinking was starting to have a different underlying principle, and that is all men are born with equal dignity. So the fact that I was born to a peasant farmer and you were born to a lord somewhere didn't actually matter, because my inner self and who I am is just as valuable and dignified as who you are. And so why should society be able to repress the poor peasant and not the lord, because that's often how it worked, right? The guys in charge kind of conducted things however they want, but if you were the peasant, you got run around. And so everyone's authentic self, that which is kind of inside of them and most true to them, is equally valuable, and therefore a community that seeks to suppress that is actually evil, like we said. And instead, a good community has to affirm the authentic self and allow it to flourish. So this is why merely tolerating behavior isn't sufficient, right? So a lot of the arguments you hear today isn't just, well, why can't I do what I want to do in the privacy of my own home? Even if you were to say, you know what, I'm okay with that, I think it's wrong, but you know, you are doing what you want, you're not hurting me, so go ahead. There's actually a problem still, because you're not affirming the very thing that that person says that they truly are, right? You're not affirming the identity that's coming from the inside and the identity by which they're defining themselves. And so that's why you end up with, so I don't know if any of you are familiar with it, there was a case in the courts not long back where a gay couple were getting married and they wanted to have a cake baked, and they went to a baker. The guy was a Christian. He said, no, I won't bake the cake for your wedding. Well, why does that actually matter? Because it's ridiculous to suppose that that was the only guy around that could bake them a cake, right? Surely there was someone around that would have been more than happy to bake a wedding cake, because it's not just that they didn't have access to product and service, because they would have, but because the baker in question was actually, by refusing to acknowledge their marriage, was denying their authentic selves. He was denying what was inside of them and what they thought to be most true about themselves. But of course, when we talk about what we think and what we feel, we have a lot of internal thoughts and feelings, right? They're not just sexual feelings. So this raises a relevant question. Why is gender and sexuality the primary way in which we define ourselves in the 21st century? How did that actually happen? Why did that come to the forefront? So into the line of thought we've been talking about, that the way to happiness is to be as true to myself as I can. And what is true to myself is that which is authentic. It's what comes from me. Steps, Sigmund Freud. Who knows anything about Freud?
Psychoanalysis.
Good. Psychoanalysis. Yeah. So Freud was a neurologist and the father of psychoanalysis. So the father of this process of sitting down, asking questions, getting to the root of people's psychological problems. Now, interestingly, do people still think that he was right about most of his psychoanalysis stuff?
No.
Yes. No, you're right the first time. You had a 50-50 shot, but then you blew it by saying both. They say he's crazy. So in modern day psychology, his psychoanalysis sort of theories are essentially disproven. They're not credible at all. No one actually thinks he was right. But one of the things that he did and that he introduced into the culture at the time that has permeated everything is the centrality of the sexual to who you really are as a person. And in a way, we can actually look at his introduction of that as kind of like a myth. So not a myth in the sense of we all know this is false, but a myth in the lines, maybe think of like the Greek gods, right? The story about the Greek gods, they never really claim that it's exactly true. And it's not really the point. The point of them isn't whether it's true or not. The point is, with this sort of myth-making, with this elaboration of this other world, the Greeks were able to order their society and direct certain things. And so whether the stories are true or not were actually completely irrelevant, right? They didn't really matter to Greek society. What mattered was that they functioned in a certain way. And so what happened with Freud is very similar. His theories, etc., aren't regarded as being true or accurate anymore. But he's left the world with a myth that the world has continued to believe in. And it's a compelling myth. And the myth is that sex, in terms of desire and fulfillment, is the actual key to human existence. And we can see this in the way that sex dominates literally everything. I mean, so much advertising is based around sex, right? You've probably heard the adage from somebody, sex sells. Our advertising is based around it. Our discussions are based around it. People's political platforms are based around it. It seems like one of the prime arguments today. And so we can see that culture's really bought into this idea that at the center of who I really am, the person that I really am inside, the primary question is a sexual one. It's who am I attracted to, or am I not attracted to anyone? What do I feel in regards to my sexuality? Who am I? What gender am I? And not any other questions. And so what does this mean for mankind if you give into this line of thinking? Last week, I asked a question from the Westminster Shorter Catechism, and I forget, I think it was Peyton. Did you answer it? It was Peyton. It's always Peyton. It's either Peyton or you.
Well, I only answer just because I want to. You have to answer that.
Don't sell yourself short. Okay, so what was that? We asked the question, what's the chief end of man? Does anybody remember other than Peyton? Did anybody eternalize his knowledge?
To glorify God.
To glorify God, and there's a second part. I heard it, but it was from a sponsor. So anybody that heard the sponsor could say it.
Enjoy him forever.
And enjoy him forever, right. The answer is to glorify God and enjoy him together. That statement encapsulates both the future and the present, right? One of the things we said last week was this whole viewpoint has a view that man is a high and unique creation because of his dignity from God's image, right? But it has a purpose. Creation has an end to it, and that end is for man to glorify God and enjoy him forever. So in his life, man is to glorify God and enjoy him, but forever. So there's a future that is more important in biblical terms than the present, that man is to continue to enjoy God and glorify him forever. But if we start to say that my sexual desire and fulfillment is actually the key to my happiness, and it's actually the thing that defines me the most, what does that do to that timeline? Well, it cuts it off, right? Because none of us are going to live forever in the way we live now, right? We understand that the human body has limitations and eventually it's going to cease to be able to enjoy those pleasures in the first place, and eventually we're all going to die, right? So at some point, my ability to be who I truly am and to be this authentic self is going to stop. And so we begin to see a culture that demands living in the present and fulfilling its desires in the present without regard for the future, because the future is unimportant. It isn't able to fulfill who I truly am. And I think we can see that take hold, right? The person who, as frequently as possible, is indulging in their sexual desire as a means to happiness is normative, right? It's normal for people in our culture just to do whatever makes them happy sexually and to be primarily focused on that. But that creates a problem, right? So what's happened here is that we've actually taken man and we've elevated him. We've elevated him as an individual. We've actually said that what's going on inside of man is more important than anything outside of him, and more important than whatever his community might want to impose on him. In fact, the community should acknowledge him and affirm him and support what's coming from inside of him. But we still have this theoretical problem, right? There's this natural law, divine law, that sort of hangs over creation and hangs over man and hangs over our communities. So what happens there? How do we deal with that? How is that dealt with in the mindset that has accepted this truth or supposed truth about man, about his sexuality? So we'll talk about natural law first. And there's two ways that nature kind of generally asserts itself, controlling us and consequences for the stuff that we do. So think about primitive man, right? Go way back to our earliest ancestors. And they were very much controlled by nature, in a sense, right? So you had to live by what? What's one of the most important things that humans have to live by?
Food.
Okay, what else? Water. How do you get food? Somebody said it. Water, right? You had to live by water, because in order to grow crops, in order to have something to drink, you had to have a water source. And so at some point in our history, there was this sort of natural control that nature imposed over us. Eventually, what did man figure out how to do?
Store water.
And what else? Redirected irrigation, right? So man figures out, hey, you know what? If we dig this thing and we order it in such a way, we can actually make the water flow over here where we want to live and not over there where the water is. And so what happens is man begins to be able to control nature, right? Through tools, through irrigation, through the explosion of technology. So industrial revolution and come up to today, all the ways that technology is able to help us to control nature. Nature begins to not seem so big and so meaningful anymore. Man is allowed to see himself as the one that can shape everything around him. To the extent of, even in our present day, right, when we talk about gender issues, to even do things that change my biological appearance. And so technology has enabled man to look at this natural law and say, I can overcome that. That has no hold over me. The other way that we said was consequences, right? So there are certain things that if we do them, nature just by itself has certain consequences to those actions. So if we talk about sexual activity, right, one of the consequences is reproduction, for example, or disease, these things that happen as a function of sexual activity. And so at some point in the past, that had some level of control over how I acted and what I did sexually, because for obvious reasons. But now we have medication, we have technology that can actually subdue those consequences and takes them out of the picture. So if I want to act a certain way, we've developed technology that lets me act in a certain way. Nature no longer really has any sway over whether or not I can act that way. And so there's this problem philosophically still, right? Where how do we deal with this whole concept? How do we deal with God as creator and passing down this natural law? Well, enter who? Any ideas? Who had the most impact on that little string? No. You just gave the Sunday school answer, but it's completely wrong in this case. Charles Darwin, right? And the idea of Charles Darwin and the theory of evolution. Evolution has a couple of things that are really, really go in its favor. The basic idea is simple, right? The underlying science may be complex, but this discussion actually, much like Freud's theories, whether or not Darwin's right actually has nothing to do with it. Because the underlying theory is relatively simple. It's easy to understand that one thing over time, and if the Earth is old enough, might morph into another thing. It might change into something else. The most prominent example that it holds forth, so the idea of apes evolving to humans seems plausible, right? You look at certain apes and it's like, you know what, yeah, I could see that. I could see how there's some similarities there and how one of them might transition to another. It's been made easily accessible. So writers of all kinds have picked it up and used it and put it into the cultural mindset. And so it's easily accessible to most people. It made the case for man's existence without God in a scientific way. And so that's important, right? Because science carries a social authoritative weight in our culture, right? Science saying something is important. It is meaningful to people. It's meaningful in a culture where science has done so much for them and technological developments, and science holds a certain amount of authority. And so for Darwin to be able to explain how we exist without God in a scientific way is helpful. Ultimately, what happens is evolutionary theory allows human beings, and by association our natures, so that which is inside of us, to be relativized, right? This idea that we were created for a purpose, that we were created to glorify God, that there's a future destination to all things, is no longer necessary philosophically, because that entire thing is tied into God as creator. And so with the science of evolution, we're able to kind of break all of these connections. And so man now is able to have a scientific explanation for why he is able to be who he truly is, and that who he truly is inside of himself. But the result, right, so there's still a problem. So we still have books like the Bible. We still have people who make claims that God exists and that he has said certain things and that we have to obey by certain things. Anybody familiar with the phrase, God is dead?
Oh, that's Nish. Nish, how are
you saying it? Did somebody say it over here?
I said it, but let's keep going.
Please, Noah, enlighten us. Enlighten us. Who said it?
Is he president?
Nietzsche. Yeah. Close enough. Close enough. It's good. It's good. It's good. Okay. So we're familiar with that phrase. Now, how have you usually heard it, right? God is dead. Well, okay. So you may have heard a Christian make that joke. God is dead. Nietzsche's dead, which is true and slightly funny. But it's usually said in such a way that's sort of just like this placid statement, right? Well, God is dead. But the place where that statement actually shows up in Nietzsche's writings is far, far different from just sort of this placid statement that God is dead. And I want to read to you some of what Nietzsche wrote where this statement comes out. It's probably the only time you will hear Friedrich Nietzsche wrote in Link for the rest of your time here. So listen up. This is from a book called The Gay Science or The Joyful Wisdom. And gay in this case, joyful, that's why joyful is there, meaning happy. It's sort of the older use of the word, not our modern usage. Just so you don't accidentally tie it into more than I intended you to. The madman. Have you not heard of that madman who lit a lantern in the bright morning hours, ran to the marketplace and cried incessantly, "I seek God! I seek God!" As many of those who did not believe in God were standing around just then, he provoked much laughter. "Has he got lost?" asked one. "Did he lose his way like a child?" asked another. Is God hiding? Is he afraid of us? Has he gone on a voyage? Emigrated? Thus they yelled and laughed. The madman jumped into their midst and pierced them with his eyes. "Whither is God?" he cried. "I will tell you. We have killed him, you and I. All of us are his murderers." And then he goes on to talk about how did we do this, and he uses flowing, eloquent language of all the ways in which man has been able to kill God. And then he comes back to it and says, "How shall we comfort ourselves, the murderers of all murderers? What was holiest and mightiest of all that the world has yet owned has bled to death under our knives. Who will wipe this blood off of us? What water is there for us to clean ourselves? What festivals of atonement? What sacred games shall we have to invent? Is not the greatness of this deed, that is the killing of God, too great for us? Must we ourselves not become gods simply to appear worthy of it? There has never been a greater deed, and whoever is born after us for the sake of this deed, he will belong to a higher history than all history hitherto. God is dead. God remains dead, and we have killed him." So what's going on in that passage that Nietzsche wrote? His main point is that reason, so through the Enlightenment, has put an end to God. Man was able to sit and think philosophically and reason himself into an existence where God was no longer necessary. He was no longer required. And so man had developed this philosophy that cut this line out entirely. In fact, cut God out of the picture entirely. But in that era, there was politeness, ease almost, for those even that adapted themselves as atheists. And what Nietzsche is saying through the man-man is that these men that have made themselves to be able to reason God away have not actually wrestled with the ramifications of what they've done. What he's saying is that as men that has finally gotten rid of God, we're still living as if some of this stuff still exists. We're still living with so much of a framework from Christianity and other religions that God created, and that there's these laws and our society is ordered around it. And he says, we can't do that. We must not do that. In fact, as the men that have killed God, we have to be the ones to create new law, to create a new way of thinking and a new way of viewing the world now that we have put God to death. And so it's not a simple, placid, polite statement of God's death, but a cry for man to be something more now, to take the reins of himself and of his future and of culture and philosophy. And so the chains that Nietzsche wanted to see men free themselves from included these three things, which are really helpful for our discussion. Number one, the idea of a common human nature, right? So when we talk about who we are as a person and our nature, who we are inside, remember Christianity says that flows out of God, and it flows out of this idea that God created man in his image. Well, Nietzsche says if we've gotten rid of God, this idea that we all have this shared nature, this something about us that is unique to humanity but shared among all of us, is completely unnecessary. The individual human nature may differ from person to person, and so who you are and what you believe yourself to be doesn't have to be reconciled with who I am and what I believe myself to be. They can be completely independent. Morality is nothing more than personal preference. So if what we've done here is we've removed these laws, if we've said because we've gotten rid of God and of creation, these laws no longer apply, what I think is moral or good is mostly my personal preference. Now, I might, as a society, we may have similar personal preferences. We may come together and say, you know what, this sounds good to us. We all want to stay alive, so let's all agree not to kill one another. But ultimately, the reason we don't kill one another is because we've all decided that we shouldn't kill one another. It's not because man is a holy and special creation from God. And finally, the idea of any intrinsic meaning in the universe. So this idea of man glorifying God and enjoying him forever, gone. If the universe is nothing but the random happenstance of matter, there is no meaning in the universe. There can't be meaning in the universe because meaning has to be derived from somewhere. And so to look at our lives as something that we have to order around a cosmic reality is completely ridiculous and unnecessary. And so what this gives rise to is a humanity that can bend itself to its own will because it's not constrained by a moral lawgiver or a moral source. And so when we combine our technological ability to overcome nature, our philosophical ability to dispense with the need of God, we get a humanity that finds its truest self, meaning, and purpose inside of each individual person. And so community has to then affirm my inner self and my inner person, or community is evil. And so this general path is how we find ourselves where we are today, right? Where if I decide that I am attracted to members of the same sex, well, sex is the critical thing in my life that makes me happy. It is the most central part of who I am as a person. And so I'm not simply asking for your permission to commit an act. I'm asking you to acknowledge that who I am as a person, my human nature, is homosexual. And so we are dealing with a completely different paradigm than we have dealt with historically, right? This is completely incompatible with the Christian worldview and the Christian way of explaining who we are and why we live the way we live. And so the reason I want to draw that out is not just so that you understand, you know, the people that feel this way, the people that speak this way, there actually is a philosophical undergird to them thinking that way. It's not just, oh, well, they're sinful people. There's actually a system of thought that makes what they think makes sense. So that if you're exposed to that, it's not the first time you hear it, and you say, oh, wow, I didn't realize this actually made sense. Well, it can make sense for a certain way of looking at the world. And also, as we interact with that culture, which we're going to talk about next week, I got a couple of really great questions, happy to take some more, but we're going to talk about next week, well, what do we actually do? How do we live in a culture that we can't even have a realistic discussion with because the places we're starting are completely opposed to one another? And so we are going to get to that next week. I want to bring this around to wrap up real quick. When Dan introduced this series last week, he reminded you of the verses in Ephesians about deceitful schemes, about the way the devil would seek to attack us and to have us try to think and believe things that God hasn't said. And I wanted you to notice something about the philosophy behind this that makes us particularly susceptible to this and to other things, because I think understanding how the devil works in crafting deceitful schemes will help you look out for other ones. So notice three things. Number one, the devil's deceitful scheme almost always has some element of truth to it. I don't know if you picked this up when I was talking about the contrast of the feudal sort of existence of the lords and the peasants, but I said the thought of every human being possessing equal dignity. Well, you know what? That's actually true. We affirm that. Christianity says, yes, every human being has equal dignity because every human being is created in the image of God. And so within this philosophical system that's completely opposed to God is this nugget of truth that, yes, we all are actually possessing dignity because of God's creating us. The second is an air of plausibility. This idea that, you know what, I do think things inside myself and I have desires, they make me happy to do them. So clearly, the system that allows me to do them and allows and forces you to affirm my decision, well, that sounds good to me. That sounds plausible. It seems like, you know what, things really might be this way. And they often appeal to us by twisting good gifts of God. So sex is a gift that God has given and it's a good thing. God created it. But this scheme twists this gift of God into something that actually destroys us. The best place to see this, right, is in the garden. Because what does Satan do when he talks to Eve? He includes some element of truth. God told you not to eat. Now, he stretches it a little bit and says, God told you you can't eat from any of the trees, or did God really say that? But he has some element of truth there. You know what? God did tell her not to eat from the tree. There's an air of plausibility. So he suggests this idea that what God's really concerned about is that if you eat it, you'll be more like him. And he doesn't want that. And if you think about it, well, yeah, maybe this God that created me and I'm here and put this thing here, and maybe I would, and maybe that's what he's worried about. And it's appealing by twisting God's good gifts. God had given them plenty to eat. He'd given them plenty of trees, plenty of things in the garden. They had more than they needed. But Satan twisted this good thing that God gave into something that ultimately destroyed them and ultimately needed a savior and needed a Messiah to come and pay for all of the sin that man would commit. So be on the lookout for not just these things, but anything that the devil crafts. It often, again, has some element of truth to it. It seems plausible, and it often twists something good that God has given you. So that's going to wrap us up for today. I'm going to pray in a second. Again, I'll reiterate. I got a couple questions. Happy to throw a few more in, try to fill our time out next week. You can drop those in the box, text me, email, call. If you don't have my number, feel free to yell at your parents nicely and request that they look it up in the directory. But yeah, reach out. Let me know of any questions you might have. We'll hit the questions I got next week and just kind of wrap up with some thoughts about how we live and how we go forward in a culture where we are increasingly not at home. So let's pray, and then we'll enjoy some donuts and juice. Father, thank you that you do love us. Thank you that you are the creator that has made all things and that you made man in your image and that you made us with the intention of blessing us and blessing us with your presence and blessing us with your glory and blessing us with all of creation. And we thank you that in Jesus you have paid for our sins, that you have perfectly obeyed your law, and that he has risen and able to save and secure us forever, and that in him we can look forward to a day when we know nothing but the blessing of God because of what Christ has done for us. Father, keep us in your will. Keep us from sin. Keep us from deceitful schemes. Father, I pray that you would protect each and every one here from falling into thinking of law and the ways of the evil one, but that you would keep us in your will, in your ways, and in your word. Now, Father, bless the rest of this day. Bless our time tonight, and bless now the food that we're going to eat. Help us have a good time together. In Jesus' name, amen.